KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for nearly 50 years. You were an important part of this work, and your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join your friends and neighbors in supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. Help us make our $18,000 goal before December 31st. Go to the giveguide.org website and find KBOO in the Creative Expression section. And as always, thank you for your support of KBOO.
It's 11 o'clock. Time for Steam Radio Syndicate, Big Rock Candy Mountain. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
T-Box and I caught a ride to Bend the long way, stopping in Oak Ridge briefly to raid the rest stop of Free Railroad postcards. We lounged lazily on the train tracks behind a small park at the end of Southeast Railroad Street, about a half mile south of the Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Yard office.
Radio Syndicate broadcast live from the deck on the UV 746 tugboat on the Willamette River. Nate Klett is our McClintock historian, and Aaron Dactyl, author of the zine Railroad Semantics, reads from his travelogue.
There was a basketball hoop there, and after finding a basketball behind one of the houses next to the tracks, we shot hoops while waiting for a northbound train. Partly cloudy, it felt like early fall at about 70 degrees with the air fresh and cool like high altitude air and the sun warm on my skin.
Thank you. First time I ever heard it was your singing of it back in San Francisco a long time ago.
There were at that time, and I guess still are, springs there that are so strongly, the water is so strong with soda that all you need is a glass of water out of one of those springs and sprinkle a little lemon juice in it.
Harry McClintock, the man history attributes with writing Big Rock Candy Mountain, led an appropriately fantastical life. Born in 1882, McClintock left Knoxville, Tennessee at the young age of 14 to join the circus, the Gentry Brothers Dog and Pony Show. A couple of years later, McClintock ended up in the Cultural Cauldron of New Orleans, surrounded by transients, train hoppers, and hobos. It was here in the Bay that McClintock began his musical career, busking on the streets for spare change. Anyone who can sing never has to go hungry, he later reflected. It's difficult to piece McClintock's varied life together chronologically, but along the way, he worked the railroads in Africa, delivered supplies by mule to American troops during the Spanish-American War in the Philippines, and assisted journalists in China during the 1899 Boxer Rebellion. Once back in North America, he joined the 100,000 prospectors who headed to the Yukon during the grueling expedition that was the Klondike Gold Rush. At other times, he was a sailor, miner, cowboy, shepherd, union organizer, mule skinner, railroad brakeman, medicine show performer, and steamboat entertainer. Somewhere in between all this action, he was a hobo.
Desert grass, overgrown and yellow, sprouted from a sand and rock ground littered with pieces of broken appliances, shopping carts, empty bottles, shards of glass, and dry splinters of wood. Some industry churned quietly in the distance and odd bird chirps rained down from the ponderosas, but nothing predicted an approaching train. With no activity besides a BNSF worker truck gliding past on the rails, T-Box dozed off under the shade of a pine tree. And feeling slap-happy tired from last night's trek down from Portland, I thought I might as well nap too, since I know too well now that trains never come when you are waiting for them. We were awoken by some jerk yelling relentlessly at his dog, which was just running around in the park. His hollers worked themselves into dreams that I soon forgot. A train horn blew faintly at the South Crossing with about an hour left of light, and moments later a junk train rolled in swiftly and stopped, halting a gondola directly in front of us. I knew the crew change in Bend was quick, but this train stopped for less than a minute, not even enough time to switch crews, and then aired up again and began to move. As I struggled to climb aboard, a bottle of bullet bourbon tumbled from my pack and shattered on the tracks below. I paused, stunned, and acknowledged the loss as the train began to inch away. T-Box, still on the ground, climbed aboard, and the train picked up speed quick.
It was on a rack with dozens of others like it, tiny booklets describing the regional attractions. The Museum of the Leprechaun, the Shrine of St. Hubert the Unknown, the world's largest billboard. And there, somewhere in the middle, I first saw the name of the place. The Big Rock Candy Mountains, it read. A land that's fair and bright. I read the words in passing, hardly slowed my pace. Fair, I thought? Bright? But I was already late for the meeting. The next morning, after proofreading the report to the finance committee, I found myself back in the lobby, standing before the array of pamphlets, gazing at the one in particular. Just as I reached a hand forward towards the glossy brochure, Stu, the regional manager, stumbled past with several boxes of donuts. "There's only a few with sprinkles," Stu said quickly. "Don't come crying to me if you don't get one." Stu insists that we call him Stryker. His elaborate comb-over is an architectural marvel. Enough dillying and dallying, he added. We've got a backlog of memos to sanitize. If you can't show up on time to our meetings, there's 1,000 applicants that can. I don't like sprinkles, I replied, and quickly snatched a pamphlet. The Big Rock Candy Mountains, it read, where you never change your socks. That night, after several rounds at the hotel bar, the scotch and soda tasted like tar and cleaning solution. I was the only patron left and had to lift my legs so the barkeep could sweep the floor beneath. And that's when I opened the pamphlet, right there on the polished bar, swiveling the stool in anticipation. Inside were shots of blissful hobos, a cigarette tree in full bloom, lemonade bubbling straight from the ground. In large sprawling letters across the top, it read, "We hung the jerk who invented work." This is it, I thought. This is what I've been searching for all along. Oh, I've tried it all. Yoga, of course, punk rock, polyamory, orgasmic baking, ecstatic jogging, but now this. Later, in my room, to the drone of late-night television laughter, I undress slowly with poor coordination. Using a pair of scissors, I snip my tie into ribbons that fell silently onto the carpeting. I drop my dress shirt into the shower and I performed unspeakable acts upon it. My shoes I threw from the 8th-floor window and waited to hear them clack on the sidewalk below. After removing my slacks, I set fire to them in the shower. I looked long and hard at my argyle socks. I will never change these socks, I vowed. In the morning, before the sun was even up, I put dollar after dollar into the vending machine, watching Snickers bars, cheese crackers, and gummy bears fall into the trough below. I wrapped them all in a pillowcase with the rest of the bills from my wallet and tied the bundle to a mop I found in the hallway. I walked past the front desk and through the sliding glass doors. And this is how I set out, wearing only plaid underpants, a white t-shirt, and the socks I'd wear forever, heading west to the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. Where the socks cars all are empty, and the sun shines every day, and the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs, where the bluebird sings, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Song that has been going around the country for quite a while and is associated with you. It's a song called The Big Rock Candy Mountain.
McClintock contends that he wrote Big Rock Candy Mountain during his time in New Orleans at the young age of 16, but this could be one of McClintock's Candy Mountain fantasies. The song may be derived from a 17th century Irish ballad, An Invitation to Lubberland. Lubberland is among a tradition of medieval utopias that captivated the peasant mind. Besides the classical Atlantis and Arcadia, each country imagined a place where food is abundant, sex is unhindered, work is unheard of, and social conventions don't exist. In Italy, there was Paese della Cocagna. In Belgium, there's Lulikerland. In Germany, there was Schlaraffenland. And in Spain, there was Waha, or Paese de Cocagna. Perhaps Big Rock Candy Mountain can be thought of as the American equivalent to these medieval utopias. The word Lubberland comes from the Swedish word lubber, for a fat and lazy man. According to the ballad, in Lubberland,
to make
Considering that it was the Chinese and Irish immigrants who built the railroads, there's good reason to believe that this Irish ballad would have ridden the rails. Whatever the origin of the song, it is nevertheless clear that it was McClintock who popularized it.
In Salt Lake City, not far from the OSL freight yards there, there's what was known as the Chicken Soup Springs. It has some sort of a chemical content. Water had a sort of a flavor, you know. It might have been chicken soup.
In his youth, McClintock performed alongside the Marxist group, the Industrial Workers of the World, also known as the Wobblies. But an older McClintock took an unhobo-like view of property, fiercely defending the copyrights to the songs he played. McClintock scoffed at the idea that folk songs are in the public domain, writing in a letter to the League of Composers, "The theory seems to be there, created by some sort of spontaneous generation." In 1928, he waged a lawsuit against a ukulele player named Billy Mack, who had published sheet music for Big Rock Candy Mountain the same year that McClintock had first recorded the song. But to McClintock's dismay, the judge ruled that Big Rock Candy Mountain was a traditional folk song, and therefore couldn't be copyrighted.
Casting live from the deck of the UV-746 tugboat on the Willamette River, this is the Steam Radio Syndicate.
With the air growing cold, a great darkness set upon the land and a million stars shone in the sky, so many that I could not discern the most basic constellations or even the Big Dipper. The faint milky fog of the galaxy band arched above at an odd degree, and the annual Perseid meteorite sparked through the atmosphere, leaving singed trails in the air that lingered for seconds after the cosmic bit had burnt. Soon, great rocky cliffs rose above the gondola walls as we entered the Deschutes River Canyon. The darkness cast on the land contrasted against the glowing night sky to create a landscape so unearthly looking that I felt as if I was on some extrasolar planet, some cold, lonely rock belonging to no particular light source other than the backdrop of a million equidistant stars light years away, drifting unorbitally through a vast and infinite universe where no other sentient being is known. The train came to a halt inside the dark shadows of the canyon walls, and we abandoned it. I walked down to the river, guided only by the sound, and nearly fell in through the reeds due to the darkness of night. Climbing back over to the other side of the train, I stepped over a low cattle fence onto a slightly sloped desert step. There, I laid my bivy out and sunk down below the sagebrush to sleep. The train cut its air, and I heard the unit's horn sound as if it were detaching. I later discerned we were near the town of Maupin. After about 20 minutes, the train aired up again and took off, this time without us. Stars shone infinite in every direction, perfect like a planetarium ceiling above only the faint sound of rushing water.
The hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farms are full of fruit and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rains don't fall and the winds don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Thank you.
Steam Folk Players play An Invitation to Lubberland from The Winch Room, and Aaron Dactyl reads from Railroad Semantics. Cat Fountain and the Hitzig Brothers playing from the Stern Deck. And now to the Meat Locker, where Leo J. continues his tale.
I walked and walked on the shoulder of the interstate towards the Big Rock Candy Mountains. My boxer shorts beginning to chafe, my permanent socks already fraying at the heel. When I stopped for lunch, I found that all of my candy bars were melted and misshapen. I squeezed the paste of what was once a Snickers bar onto a cheese cracker and topped it with gummy bears. I ate several of these. I named them Cheesy Snicker Bears, but had no one to tell this to. I drank deeply from a water fountain, dreaming of lemonade, and continued on. It was late afternoon when I first saw the sign. My feet were aching, my thirst incredible. Looming above a freeway exit was an old billboard, so sun-faded and peeling, it was nearly unreadable. But the message was clear. I had arrived. I followed the signs and arrows through a parking lot and up to a ticket booth enclosing one large woman. Above her window was a sign in red letters that said, "Absolutely no refunds." "You need a ticket?" the woman asked. "Excuse me," I said, "isn't this the land that's fair and bright?" "Yes," she said, blinking slowly. "Well, I guess I thought, are you working?" She stood suddenly, knocking a calendar to the floor. "I sure as hell ain't on vacation," she wailed. From her new vantage point, she had a much clearer view of me. "Where the hell are your pants?" I'd rather not say, I replied. "Well, I can't let you in there like that." "Please," I begged. "I've been walking all day to be here. I read your literature. I gave up my possessions. I'm so thirsty. The woman slowly lowered herself back onto her chair. For several seconds, we looked each other over through the glass. "Wait here," she said. I watched her squeeze through the back door of the booth. She returned holding a rolled-up pair of jeans, covered in iron-on patches, sloppily arranged. "These should fit," she told me, handing them over. "What is this?" I asked. "It's our uniform. Bring it back on your way out." "My way out?" I thought. Through a turnstile, I entered the grounds of the Big Rock Candy Mountains. The first thing I saw was a massive tree, covered in empty cigarette packs. "This can't be right," I thought, and pulled out the original brochure to check. Sure enough, on the page I held, the tree was clearly blooming with cigarette-petaled flowers. This looked to be nothing more than a common maple festooned with dirty old cigarette packs, like trashy Christmas ornaments. They must not be in season, I figured. I grabbed the first person walking past to find out. I noticed she wore the same pants as I did. She also had fingerless gloves on. A name tag declared her Hobo Shelley. "Do you know anything about this tree?" I implored. "Of course," she said, cheerfully. "I work here." "Work?" I cried. "Why is everyone working?" "What do you mean?" she asked, puzzled. "I thought this is where they hung the jerk who invented work." "Of course," she said. "He's buried on the far edge of the park. Just follow the sign." She motioned to a pole with several wooden stakes attached, pointing to different areas of interest, the Lake of Stew, the Lemonade Springs. Hobo Shelley walked away and started emptying garbage cans. I remembered my enormous thirst and followed the sign to the Lemonade Springs. It was true. There really was lemonade bubbling from the ground, free for the taking. But I needed to buy a souvenir cup, which cost $4.50. Also, the drink itself was far too sweet and had an odd sulfurous flavor. At the Lake of Stew, I had to pay to rent a canoe. Have you ever tried paddling through stew? It's more difficult than you might think. All around the lake, which was really a measly pond, there were wooden signs saying, "Do not eat." The edges of the pond were caked in a thick fungal growth, and the stew itself emitted a foul, bubbling gas. And there were all of these workers in matching hobo outfits, roaming around, staffing the rides and concession booths. In the food court, there were soft-boiled eggs available that, once ordered, were sent through a chute and out of the rear end of a carved wooden chicken. A rooster, nonetheless. After sundown, the wooden-legged cops made their rounds, swinging plastic billy clubs. "That's it, folks," they called. Park closes in 5 minutes. With the last of my cash, I got as many soft-boiled eggs as I could afford. I watched them roll down the chute, one after another. Each was stamped with the tiniest lettering that informed, "Consuming raw or undercooked eggs may increase your risk of foodborne illness." I took one last look at the brochure that brought me here, at the glossy paradise it offered. My cup was full of foul lemonade, my bindle stuffed with eggs and the makings of cheesy Snicker Bears. I sat in the abandoned food court, watching the sun drop behind the ordinary hills that were no mountains at all. I crumpled the brochure, slipped off my socks, and dropped them onto the ground to mix with the common trash. And I began the very long walk back.
Candy Mountain, you never have to change your socks. Little streams of alcohol come a trickling down the rocks. Brakemen have to tip their hats. Railroad bowls are blind. You can simmer it down, stir it up. Honey, once you've tried it, you can't get enough. Wine is red, sky is blue, rock candy's good for what's ailing you. Earth is boiled in oil, the inventor of the toil. Paddle all around it, your big canoe, lake of stew, big rock candy mountain.
Went to work in a county jail just south of San Francisco in San Bruno, California. I was part of a small crew that spent 4 months living out of a hotel while installing soffits in the new jail. We worked long hours, and in our off time, we took to touring San Bruno, which turned out to be kind of a weird place. Our hotel had been built on the grounds of the old Tanforan racetrack, a place where Seabiscuit had raced. There was a little plaque in dedication to that history between our hotel and the Target store, but if that wasn't enough, everything around was preceded by the name Tanforan. It was the Tanforan Target. The track had also been used by the military in World War I to house Japanese Americans during forced relocation, and in later years used as a motorcycle flat track. You could find photos of those days just about anywhere in town. On the west side of San Bruno were the dark green coastal hills that separated San Bruno from the ocean. Buckeyes, redwoods, and pines, blanketed by ocean mist and fog at almost any time of day. If you ventured south, just 5 miles, you find the city of Colma. It was more like a small town that stretched along the railway where the dead outnumber the living. This is the consequence of an ordinance in 1900 banning the construction of cemeteries in San Francisco. We had a beer in an old bar there and discovered the walls displaying articles and photographs of coffins floating in a Colma intersection during a flood 80 years ago. During the workday, I was entering a construction zone no less interesting. Passing through a sheriff's gate, I showed my ID and neared the clover-shaped building against the hills. Even before I got out of the van, I tasted concrete dust and fumes of industrial paint. Inside, each man standing had a lamp illuminating the dankness where they worked. Uncured concrete and glassless windows took in the mist at night and kept the building slate gray and damp. More than anything, the light made everything darker, revealing something underground. And no matter the job, any man's tool would ring in your ears for hours and bring the smell in your hotel room at night. My job was to surround the cells, common spaces, and halls with steel soffit for fire sprinklers. These areas were the wards, and each ward had about 100 double occupancy cells. They were curved, creating an arced common room for 200 people. And though I worked with a partner, I often backtracked alone to put in rivets down the line. There was a time I found myself drifting into thought, looking deeply into a cell and participating. It's not wider than an arm's width in any direction. The wet gray wall feels cool and impressive, unexploited by anyone before me. There's a toilet and a sink, but they're not plumbed in yet. I sit down on the toilet and look out to the common space. It's hazy with dust. A guard tower in the common space is in direct sight, and aside from a short concrete wall that goes up to my knees, anyone can see me. There's a shiny stainless steel soffit that runs along the ceiling to the back of the cell and turns. And in the wall to the back is the window. The opening itself reveals the vast thickness of the wall. The inside edge is beveled. It's really the room's only ease. It's tall but narrow, not wide enough to fit my head through. I get up from the toilet, drawn toward it. Beyond the window, the sun is setting, leaving behind twilight and bits of light in the trees, making some places hidden and mysterious and others playful and loping. The fog folds with intent over the hill and toward me. It's guiding mist so thick I can feel the drops on my face. And suddenly, I arrive at this totally unexpected destination. Out there, in the hills of San Bruno, I am awake.
Kitty Rocket's memoir, Pipe from the Steam Locker, music from the Stern Deck by Hans Nickchurch and Tevin Hodge. This is the Steam Radio Syndicate, a radio collective broadcasting from the deck of the massive steam warship UV-746 on the Willamette River.
Riding further and further, hugging the slats of the Great Western Rail Line to the vanishing point, I inject the last of my butterscotch interest inhibitors and lift my hoary transgenic hound face to the eternal sun that shines over the mountain. Benny F. and dedicated Shabazz play Red Dice Year Out with wood chips because
we aren't going to need cyber currency where we're going.
I'm plagued by dreams of helium trees, little streams of pure novapentin, and lakes of liquid drizzle shark clone soup to, like, eat from sometimes. Benny F. says,
you know, the jails there are made of pink cellophane. Man, I'm going to cut out every night and do whatever I want.
Dedicated Shabazz nods,
we're going to break this place with impunity. Blast, my people. Blast!
We jump off the train into a big lemonade arroyo. The mountain. At last. Benny F. is naked.
I left my clothes on the train. The sun shines every day. I'll steal everything I see and sell it back in Western Transit Town.
Dedicated Shabazz steps out nude, Hellenistic, proud of his gray skin.
Do you want to die? If you steal from a place like this, you'll open it up to DNA memory transplant dealers and dry ice pimps. Die on these trees are growing maple bacon.
He drinks deep from the lemonade spring. We eat our favorite foods out of the wilderness on the foothills. I hold up a stray hen, letting soft-boiled dino sour eggs fall into my mouth. Dedicated Shabazz catches a cotton candy tumbleweed. Benny F. finds a barn full of hay and tries to light it on fire because he once saw a barn burn down in a film. But the winds don't blow, so he crawls deep into the fresh hay and falls asleep like one of the forgotten angels. Dedicated Shabazz prays to the south.
Hang the jerk that invented work.
Hang the jerk that invented work. Hang the jerk that invented.
Mount Candy Rock is melting. The eternal sunlight claws away at it, cracking it open to reveal ever darker, ever redder candy. The time of reckoning. Benny F. jumps out of the barn like a blind porter.
Everything is so good here, but why haven't I achieved the unconscious orgasm yet?
I leap over a belching fumarole of molten candy, nearly passing out from the inferno of burning sugar. The microvapors enter me and turn the nucleus of every cell into a crystal candy lattice, a lollipop out of my liver, stringy nicotine-infused bubblegum in my lungs, and a chocolate tumor beneath the parietal lobe of my brain. Dedicated Shabazz points to the mountain.
Now, what's living up there now? You'll need some costly equipment to explore that piece of cruel.
The sugar walls are steaming. I tear my aeration vest into pieces and wrap it around my blistering hands and feet. I lurch onto the first big candy rocks of the mountains. I'm wild, like a dog, for the sugary slope. So many smells. Butterscotch, vanilla, sherry, lime.
Orient.
I'm really high up on the big rock candy mountain.
idea of what lies ahead or if it's inhabitable. I look down to dedicated Shabazz. He's so far below now, but his gray skin stands out on the candy-coated ground because no candy has ever been gray. He yells,
"You must climb to the true candy source! Are any of God's children up there?
I don't think anyone lives here anymore!" Now I can see Benny F. swimming down there, his broad pink shoulders and shaved pink head poking out with manic glee.
This lemonade's turned into hot butter. I think I'm gonna die like a really tasty fish.
Yeah, well, my entire body is stuck to the Big Rock Candy Mountain. My new sugary skin caramelizes and flakes. I only have a second to decide. Jump 23 stories into hot butter or become the nougat corpse at the center of the world's end truffle. I decide not to decide. Let fate suck on this. I fall down the Big Rock Candy Mountain, breaking all of the bones in my body except the ones in my dog face, which is an impenetrable mask of toughness.
You can't fall off a mountain.
Benny F. tracks the radio signal in my upper canine, finds me, and hauls me out of the butter spring and away from the candy. He drags me through a forest that drips pork rheas, solenoid boar pate, and rare gunfish eggs. He hoots like a happy monster as he hurls my broken body into the caboose of the Great Eastern Rail Line.
Hold still, man. You're gonna die soon, but we're gonna live to tell your story.
Dedicated Shabazz chips away at the toffee mask over my face to inject the low-dome chocolate rehumanizer nanodrones he has been saving for this kind of occasion.
No one has been to the Big Rock Candy Mountain and beat it. Trees implanted with dream actualizer microchips, sentient robot cops stuck in sleep mode, and a trans-dimensional petal-lover-fool. I'm not denying this utopian reality, but people have got to do some real archaeology around here. Find some bodies filled with all of God's goodness. You show me that science. The last meals they ate, the bountiful gold they stuck up every orifice. Yeah, I'll respect their ancient society like a slave. But until then, I think it's all the devil's work.
I begin to nod off from the low down. I want to go back to the mountain. Ugh, after I heal. Before it melts under that eternal bastard sun. I want to sit in my consciousness regression unit, make impossible promises, and taste all it has to offer. Chicory, juniper, coffee, sweet potato, nicotine, ink, agave, rosemary, belladonna, red root, watermelon, blackberry, sea salt, triple cream, honey.
And you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no shorthand shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm bound to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the jerk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Liminal Theater performing Mountain High from the Winch Room. This is the Big Rock Candy Mountain, and we are live with the Invention of Work, presented by Jim Petzl, Sam Mowry, and Mary Mack.
They hung the jerk who invented work. I like that line. In fact, like it so much, I decided to find the jerk. I looked into it, went to the 12th century, where the great plagues decimated the population and caused a labor shortage, resulting in the invention of true wages in exchange for services. Thus, a critical divide was created between the employer and the employed, and lurking like a shadowy phantom, capitalism. But work, labor, and toil had been around long before, so I delved further. In fact, I got biblical. And it turns out, Adam and Eve were put in Eden to work the garden, and God himself labored for 6 days to create the universe, and on the seventh day rested. So, imagine, if you will, God placing his thumbs on his temples, his index fingers like antennae extended toward the center of the universe, conjuring up the voice of his boss, the Supreme Being. God actually had, among other earthly objects, an original iPhone 1, rendered somewhat useless by the lack of cell towers in heaven. So, fingers pointed skyward.
Is anybody out there? Hello? God calling.
Oh, God. Not you.
Yes.
Long time, God. What can I do for you?
Well, yes, it's been nearly a week.
Mm-hmm.
I have been working diligently, trying to keep the children from destroying everything in creation and...
You sound tired. Did I miss something, honey?
Well, perhaps you did. On my first day off, they invented killing each other. On Monday, riches, wealth, poverty, and hunger.
Uh-huh.
On Tuesday, crusading and slaughter.
Oh,
let's see, Wednesday was slavery, and now they're lighting up little suns on the surface of the planet, fouling the water, filling the skies with smoke, modifying genetics. My job? Generally altering the fragile balance of things, dividing the planet, having at each other with weapons of mass destruction. Now they want me to like them on Facebook.
God, that's some crazy stuff there. Keeping you on your toes, huh? So, what can I do?
Well, I was thinking I could use a little help here.
Yeah?
Frankly, I'm at the end of my rope. It's just work, 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 and this is only the second week on the job. What are you doing tomorrow?
Oh, well, God, despite the sound of my voice, I'm a... gelatinous mass of collective consciousness. I have no hands, no feet, no natural means of conducting the business of, quote, work, unquote. I just absorb it all, the good and the bad. I let it simmer, slow cook, so to speak. I am, soup. Yum.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to me to keep a lid on things,
Did you think you could just create all this? Give the kids wants, desires, feelings, and free will? Did you think that somehow a dollop of conscience was going to keep them from destroying it all? Think again, God. This is going to be work. Buck up and face the music, pal. This is no Big Rock Candy Mountain, you know.
Big Rock what?
I'm sending you a podcast now. Should be there.
Okay.
Listen, what day is it there?
Friday. It's Friday.
Alrighty then. Tomorrow, take a little time from your day. Try to relax. Come Sunday, take the whole day off. Put an old 45 on your phonograph and do a little dance. Everything will be okay. You've earned another day of rest, G.
Well, you know what happened the last time I tried to...
Relax. It was always the great experiment, honey. There are other experiments should this one fail. Get back to me in a week or so.
Well, okay. Thanks, Supreme Being. I feel better already. Good night, Supreme.
Good night, God.
On the downslope, the train stopped for 30 minutes at Upton Siding, which allowed us to walk the line and explore the high desert landscape of sagebrush, ponderosas, and oversized pine cones, until a northbound train passed. But before the train passed entirely, our train began to inch south, sending us running frantically back to the escaping gondola. All made it, though. From there began the slow, grinding descent around Sawmill Curve, past a rusted old derailment wedged into the cement-covered cliffside, the train screeching down nearly 1,000 feet of elevation in a mere 10 miles, then wrapping around Kantara Loop and crossing the Sacramento River into the Dunsmuir Canyon. The train crosses again and again the river, crossing the third time on a 1901 constructed railroad bridge 3 miles north of Dunsmuir, where downstream Mossbray Falls, unchanged, spills forth idyllically in cool shade. None of of us would have minded the train pulling into the yard so we could go into town for food and beer, but the train stopped to crew change just beyond the Arch Bridge. It was hardly even noon, and in a last-minute consensus, we decided the weather was nice enough to warrant a swim in the river, and so we caught off in Dunsmuir and stashed our bags in a discreet jungle up the cliff from the tracks, then hiked up the hill and over to a nearby gas station for cold beer. We sat in the frigid Sacramento River, rinsing off and drinking beer, most of us. After that, we clambered around on the tracks and napped in a shady jungle. Chuck had brought his banjo, and later, by the river, under the bridge, he began claw hammering to the tune of Freight Train, an old Appalachian ballad by Miss Elizabeth Cotton. I did not immediately recognize the song being strung on an open-tuned banjo, but the beauty of its melody struck me familiarly like a Mozart concerto. Originally from Maryland, Chuck is a true loner among us who I did not dislike but never trusted entirely, and that is one reason I think him so close to being an older generation tramp than any of the rest of us, and I respect him. At a little over 30, he has without a doubt ridden trains all over this country, working, playing music, and just surviving. Most recently, he was living in the Portland metro area where he had a job, but it didn't work out. He is headed to San Francisco for a concert, and from there hitching up to Laytonville to do what so many tramps do this time of year, make money on the hill. And though he travels mostly alone, his gift of hammering the banjo is enough to keep him company in times forlorn.
Oh, freight train, freight train, oh, so fast. Freight train goes so fast. Oh, don't tell what train I'm gone. Then they won't know what route I've gone. Oh, when I'm dead and in my grave, no more good times here I'll crave. Oh, place the stones in my head and feet. Then tell them off gone sleep.
A little western town with silos and corrugated metal buildings, and the train cuts straight through everything, even the downtown. An abandoned warehouse with tracks not being used. Back out into the fields of grass pastures, hay, some mountains appearing on the southwest horizon. Mile 157.1, red charred spanning endlessly to the horizon of every distance. Craggy mountains with clouds hanging above them.
Radio Syndicate's River Folk Series, The Big Rock Candy Mountain. We'd like to thank all of our performers, Cat Fountain and the Hitzig Brothers, Leo J., Kitty Rocket, Nate Klett, Mary McDonald Lewis, Sam Mowry, Elizabeth Pixley Fink, Aaron Dactyl, Jim Petzl, Tevis Hodge, Hellbender Hans, and our orchestra, Bryce Castor, violin, Lisa Lipton on clarinet, Keith Bishop on bassoon, Carmen Everingham on cello, Justin Rawls as the composer, Liminal Theater, including Leo Daedalus, John Bresenton, Alex Reagan, and Amanda Bokelheide. Our crew for this event is D. Neil Blake, Bennett Bailey, Brian Benson, Elizabeth Pixley Fink, Siegfried Siegler, Travis Becker, Travis Stanton, Ruby Grigsby Schultz, Jess Evans, Max Markley, Kate Wiley, Hannon Welch, Jonathan Eady, Daniel Harrington, Sarah Giles. Green Anchors is Mark Fishers, Matt Stein, Kevin Dermott, Susan Griswold, and Scott Sutton. And last but not least, the Syndicate. Galen Huckins, Nate Klett, Hannah Cram, Max Markley, Jim Petzl, Joel Shupak, and Kitty Rocket. We'd like to ask a special thanks to the Willamette River Radio Workshop, Liminal Theater, and Poddington Bear.
Get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Carrie from the Oregon Cultural Trust, Oregon's unique engine for funding culture, including KBOO Radio. Oregonians can double the love for culture by making a donation to the Cultural Trust before December 31st that matches the donation they made to KBOO or one of more than 1,400 arts, heritage, or humanities organizations across the state. At tax time, the donation to the Cultural Trust is refunded via Oregon's Cultural Tax Credit. Donors double their impact at no cost to them, and culture across the state wins big. Visit culturaltrust.org to learn more.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need mine.
Hope you might join us on New Year's Day of 2018 from 8 a.m. to noon for a special Michael Wells Memorial Dawn Concert. Michael Wells was a longtime KBOO volunteer, programmer, and worked as station manager and board member. Michael passed away last year. His many friends from KBOO and his family thought it would be a nice gesture to honor him by having a special Dawn Concert program to start the new year. In the early days of KBOO, Dawn Concert was a regularly scheduled morning program with a variety of program hosts. That's Dawn Concert honoring the late Michael Wells from 8 a.m. to noon on Monday, January 1st, 2018. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, beginning at 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Rocker T is from Brooklyn and has 7 albums released by a number of labels playing reggae and reggaeton. Also performing will be local artist Aaron Nigel Smith, Heavy City, and DJ Kansaman. Again, that's Rocker T and the 7th Street Band on Saturday, January 6th, 9 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, and now the world, streaming online at KBOO.FM. Hello, world. This is KBOO.
I took a ride to that Big Rock Candy Mountain and kind of on a sugar high right now, it seems like. As we take you to faraway places and bring them home to you,